Good morning, everyone. I'll open the hearing for the District Plan Review hearing of submissions, further submissions. Could you just turn that down slightly, please? Is that better? Can everyone still hear me at the back? I'm not sure whether that's a puzzle that they can't hear me. I know they can. Yes. Just briefly introduce the commissioners. On my far left is Commissioner Couch Lewis and Commissioner Cox, Commissioner Gilmore. On my immediate right, Commissioner Robinson, and far right, Commissioner St. Clair. Before we go in to hear from the council, I'm going to ask Mr. Whanga to have a mihi whakatau.
Ka haia tia, ka hapara tia, ka korohi te manu, ka wairo, rore tingi tuko te atunui ka hora haina. Ka tangi tui mere ona tamariki, he pō, he awa tia. Ka tika, ka huri whakau ki te tuatai ki ta tātu atua. Nana e homai nā mea kato ki e te timutanga na whakamutukai. E whiwhi ai te ihi, te wehe, te mana, te tapu. E whiwhi ai hoki, i tēnei rā. A he rā whakahirehira ki a tātou. A rā ko kaitau kāti mamo e Waitaha. Ki nā tangata huri no i ka tātou whenua. A puta te whakaro o nā tangata ki runga, ki runga i te whenua o koutou ki te whakarongo. Nā reiri wenea ki te atua ki te aki, Manaaki a koutou ki runga i tō horai. Arā, ka pua wai te kākano, ka whakahua te kākano i mui a koutou. Reira, kia kaha, kia maia, kia manoa nui a ki runga i tō horai. Nā tātika kua huri whakaro ki tā tātou mate, huri nui te whenua. Ki tēnei taha, ki tēnā taha, huri nui ki te reringa wai wa tāngu ki a pira. Reira, nā mate o te tau, o te marama, a haere haere, oki oki ai. Reira, koutou nā kaimahi, koutou nā rangatira, tēnā koutou, whakatau mai ki rāro i te tūrniui o tā tātou maunga, rārangi e tū atu nei, ko te tapunui, ara ko te taumata o te hakitukura, kawirau, a te kamu o hakitukura, ara e te taha o tō tātou, a moana, yakatuku wai māpi. Reika, e mihi pōtō ki a koutou. Engare, e inua ki te atua, kia whakatau, te huarahi, i mui au koutou, kia tai pai te kōrero, kia tai pai ki te whakamutunga. Nereira, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou, tēnā tātou kato. Ki a koe, Dennis, kia te mihi atu ki a koe, te rangatira o tā tātou tepu, ara koutou, nā kanauna, kia te mihi atu ki a koe hoki. Nereira, koutou, nā tai mahi, nā manukiri e tai mai, koto tōtu kāo, tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou. It's me great pleasure, along with Ailsa and Naitahu, to come and support the beginning of the proceedings for our district plan. I know that a lot of effort, especially from the staff and others, and we've got people coming on to address and submit to the plan, and we'd just like to wish everyone the best. In the journey ahead of us, and here we're going to hear a lot of kōrero, and we ask that the fruits of our labour will be heard, and the kākano or the seed has been sown, and that the fruits will be heard, and it'll pōua, it'll flourish for us, the people, for our land that stands wonderfully before us. It's a wonderful land out there, as we all know. Mm-hmm. And I just want to wish everyone the best. I need a tēnā koutou, tēnā koutou.
Me
te hono tata hono, ti hunga mate ki tunga mate. Ape te hono tata hono, ti hunga ora ki tunga ora. Nere ine aske te atu ti aki, manaki te hua raki mui a tata. E rongo, whakere aki ki rongo whakamau ki e tina, hau me e hui e. Thank you very much.
Now, I neglected to mention our committee secretary today as Ms. Palmer's sitting there, who many of you have communicated with. Today is going to be dedicated to hearing from the council, including the council officers and other experts. So I'll ask Mr. Winchester to proceed. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the panel. Leave submissions have been pre-circulated. There was a synopsis of leave submissions, now full leave submissions have been provided. I probably should give an indication, sir, of some line-up changes, not necessarily in terms of personnel, but in order. And that's been driven by a range of factors, including travel and, regrettably, illness. The initial order was set out in our legal submissions at page 18. What we now propose is obviously Ms. Scott and myself will be available to speak to our submissions and answer any questions from the panel. We'll still continue with Mr. Pickard to deal with chapters 1 and 5, then move on to Mr. Third, who will give urban design evidence. We're now proposing to bring Mr. Brasner forward, who will deal with engineering matters, Dr. Reed, and possibly a change of some substance in terms of order. We thought it was logical to then bring forward Mr. Barr to talk to the officer's report for the landscape chapter. Following that, Mr. Colgrave, Dr. McDermott and Mr. Pates, and probably a chance we won't start those witnesses until tomorrow, certainly from Mr. Colgrave.
Thank you.
Now, there are two minor corrections to legal submissions. The first being at page 12, paragraph 6.35, and it's really just making sure that the sentence makes sense. It's the second sentence, which commences with the word every. It should read, every time an assessment and determination needs to be made as to the landscape classification of the site and its vicinity, full stop. And paragraph 7.2, there is a second and unnecessary use of the word also in the fourth line. So delete the second one of those. Subject to those changes, I'm in your hands as to how to deal with the legal submissions. I understand you may have read them in advance. So do you wish me to traverse the main points?
Yes, we have read them in advance. It probably would be helpful if you just addressed us on the main points.
Certainly.
And then we will discuss a variety of matters with you.
Thank you. Starting, I think, at paragraph 1.4 and 1.5, they are important factors because they set the scene for what my submission is quite a unique exercise in district planning in New Zealand. I'm certainly not aware of my experience of the combination of factors that Queenstown and Queenstown Lakes District faces and the sort of challenges that brings about, and it requires obviously a bespoke approach. So in my submission, the council situation is unique in the context of land use planning. There are significant population and urban growth pressures that are bringing about consequences that are usually regarded as big city issues, and in particular talking about the housing supply and affordability issues, which according to recent reports, becoming even more acute. but often without the majority of residents necessarily having equivalent big city income, so that has a real strain on the ability of services to cope. When coupled with a high quality natural environment, and possibly, and it's a matter of judgment and subjective judgment, possibly the most high quality natural environment in the country, which is largely the reason for growth in the first place by tourism and the corresponding growth of residents and workers. This creates significant resource management tensions and challenges that require careful management. In response to these challenges, the strategic chapters of the proposed plan include strong and directed regulatory approach in some senses, for example, urban development and landscapes, together with a more flexible and permissive approach in others, for example, the centre strategy and the relaxed provision for more high-density development in identified areas. With your leave, I will take as read sections 2 and 3. Also, I think section 4, whilst important, it is contextual. There's nothing of significant moment in there, other than, of course, an emphasis on the fact that what this exercise revolves around is Section 5 and Part 2 of the Act. I refer briefly to the requirement to have regard to various instruments from Section 74, and that's in paragraph 4.8, and paragraph 4.9, the need to give effect to national policy statements and regional policy statements. In terms of the regional policy statement, I don't necessarily want to place too much emphasis on that. Given the current operative regional policy statement, it is a reasonably broadly drafted document. There is a significant amount of latitude in my submission for the way that district plans give effect to that particular instrument. Of course, it's not necessarily part of a weighting exercise to the same extent as the proposed regional policy statement, but in my submission, it is the proposed regional policy statement that should perhaps carry a greater weight of the considerations. Now, I've attempted to set out in Section 5 of the submissions the proposed structure of this exercise. I know issues have been raised about what's been excluded and how the process has been staged. And Table 1 sets out, those from a content-based perspective, what is in Stage 1 and what is in Stage 2. And at paragraph 5.4, I've identified what has been left out altogether, and it's that essentially the operative district plan will continue. These parts of the proposed plan, as they introduce this process, will eventually join those provisions. So those are the geographical area addressed by Plan Change 50, district-wide chapters related to size and earthworks, and special zones, Maritime South and North Lake. And of course, most of those matters are subject to current or very recent plan changes, and that explains why they've been excluded from the proposed plan process. Section 6 of the submissions largely deals with historical matters in terms of how the council has got to its current position. It covers the consultation that's been undertaken and the high level of analysis of issues. I don't understand that to necessarily be a matter in dispute, but that's there for the convenience of panel members, particularly the non-elected panel members, to give an indication of, I suppose, how long this process has been going for. And it is some 3 to 4 years' worth of analysis and work to get to the current position. So while recent parts of the process have been relatively compressed, there is a long and substantial history in my submission. and Queenstown being what it is, lots of these issues get litigated again and again. So there is plenty of context. Idealist. Paragraph 6.7 through to 6.11 of the introduction chapter, and particularly its intended purpose, which is as hygiene guidance. It's not, it doesn't contain any objectives or policies, it's not regulatory in the way that it operates, it is there for information and users. Some changes, as I record it, paragraph 6.8 have been recommended by council officers to clarify the relationship of the proposed plan with national and regional plans and consultation obligations under consent applications, and that's simply to reflect the statutory position around duties to consult. Paragraph 6.9, I record there that while it's not a chapter that has regulatory effect, if any changes are made to enforce the usual rules about scope, needing to emerge from relevant submissions, that will guide your decision making and your ability to deal with that particular chapter. I think an issue has been raised as to whether this chapter should somehow record or guide how the staged approach has been undertaken by the council in terms of its notification of parts of the proposed plan. In my submission, that would not be appropriate because it would inevitably come out of date. So there are other mechanisms available through guidance and information on the council website about how this process has come about and how it's structured. That would be a better way of informing you to the public about the process that's specifically included in the introductory chapter. So I'll move on to deal with the strategic direction chapter, which I've covered from paragraph 6.12 and following. And I'll outline what it contains in paragraph 6.12. I want to emphasise the point made at the beginning of 6.13 that the level of detail that is included in this chapter is intentional and directly responds to the Council's key set of goals. And that, in my submission, is an important factor for the panel to bear in mind. There's been a number of submissions which suggest that the Strategic Directions chapter needs to either delve down into a greater level of detail or break down issues into different parts of the district. There has been significant consultation undertaken about what the key issues that this district faces are, and that's what this chapter attempts to address from a district-wide perspective. In my submission, it's not helpful to delve down to that level of detail. It needs to be kept at a high level. Importantly, however, as I cover 6.14, the chapter largely shapes and determines the proposed plan's strategic management approach, and the approach taken by the Council allows specific chapters to develop detailed policies that relate to particular issues in different environments and circumstances. And it's in those more detailed chapters that finer-grained analysis and more specific chapters to policies are appropriate. And I think paragraph 6.16 deals with the issue I've already covered about matters raised by submitters, people wanting that greater level of detail included in this chapter. I've set out in order the various goals that have been developed and how they have been responded to in the chapter, and what the recommendations of officers are for changes to this particular chapter. So the first goal is to develop a prosperous, resilient and equitable economy. And there are a number of changes, or recommended changes, that I've recorded in paragraph 6.17. And you'll hear from Dr. McDermott about the strategic function of retail and business centres and the roles that serve their importance in pursuing this first goal. And importantly, that also relates to tourism and the role and importance of tourism as a matter which has been raised by a number of submitters. But you will hear evidence from council officers as to how that has been included in the structure or in my submission, appropriately so. Secondly, the strategic and integrated management of urban growth and the approach embedded within the objectives and policies of the strategic directions chapter relates to the introduction of the urban growth boundaries for Queenstown and Wanaka and the rollover of operative urban growth boundaries for Arrowtown. The intention is recorded there. Obviously, the panel's raised an issue about current definition of urban development, and we'll be able to deal with that in due course. Thirdly, quality built environment. I won't read out paragraph 620. Goal for the protection of the built environment and ecosystems. You'll hear from Dr. Reed and Mr. Barr about that. Again, the same with goal 5, with the sacred landscapes being protected from inappropriate development. Sixth goal is to enable a safe and healthy community with a strong, diverse and inclusive for all people. And the particular issue that emerges in the strategic chapters with regard to that is around housing supply and affordability issues, primarily. And goal 7 is that the council will act in accordance with the principles of the Treaty of Waitangi in a partnership with Maitai. And you will hear from Mr. Pickard about that. The urban development chapter, there is a strong relationship with the strategic directions chapter. The council's approach is to direct future urban development within urban growth boundaries and also to encourage intensified development within certain areas within the boundaries. And you'll hear from Mr. Glazner about, in particular, about the benefits of that approach. From an engineering cost perspective. But that's not the end of the issue. There is a strong and interrelated thread of evidence that you'll hear about the benefits that this particular mechanism provide. So you hear from Dr. Reed, Mr. Bird, and Mr. Glazner, and all coming from different perspectives, they reach the same fundamental conclusions about the benefits and merits of this particular method. I recorded paragraph 6.29 that the whole issue of urban growth boundaries have had quite a lengthy genesis. That should come as no surprise. The community, through consultation, has for many years been asking the council to be more direct about where urban development takes place. So the response to the proposed plan hasn't come as a bolt from the blue. Tangawhenua chapter, I won't cover that in detail because we will hear from Mr. Pickard relatively soon, and what I've covered in paragraph 630 through to 633 effectively summarises what Mr. Pickard's opinion is. The landscape chapter, quite significant change is proposed compared to the operative district plan in terms of the way that landscapes are managed, not necessarily the outcomes that are sought to be achieved, but an explicit mapping approach is proposed in terms of outstanding natural landscapes and features that is not part of the popular district plan framework as it stands. And Dr. Reed's evidence explains why that approach has been adopted, and in my submission, it is not only sensible, but it's clear that it's likely to have benefits in terms of certainty for applicants, certainty for the community, and for administration of the plan. Ideal at paragraph 6.36 and 6.37 with some of the key themes that emerged from submissions about the landscape chapter. some saying that the proposed plan approach is too weak and others that it's too restrictive. As always, there'll be a balancing exercise that the council officers consider what we've got right in terms of the strategic approach, and obviously where the lines actually go is a matter for subsequent changes. There has been an issue raised, and it's quite a significant one, that the policies overemphasise farming and other activities based, and that other activities based in the rural area have been overlooked, particularly within the Waikato Basin and surrounds. That relates back to an issue I talked about earlier on in the submissions, that it's not appropriate, or council officers do not consider it appropriate, to focus only on discrete parts of the district, the landscape chapter and the associated rural provisions apply across all of the district, and therefore an all-of-district approach has been taken and is considered to be appropriate. That, of course, enables the specific local circumstances to be considered at plan administration and resource consent stages. Ideal of paragraph 6.39 and 6.40, with essentially summarising Mr. Carr's evidence about how rural character has been addressed in the landscape chapter. I won't have that in further detail. Now, we've set out at some length for the panel's assistance in section 7, case law around scope. And normally the issue of scope wouldn't be a big issue for an entire plan review, but when you're dealing with an entire review of the district planning, potentially everything's on the table, pretty much everything's in scope, provided it deals with a valid resource management issue. We're in a different situation here in that matters have been excluded expressly from the proposed plan, and other matters have been included in stage one and some in stage two. That creates a relatively unique and potentially quite tricky situation for submitters and for panel and for officers at the time to determine whether issues raised are live and if they are, when to deal with them. So we've tried to assist the panel with an analysis of case law, some of it which of course is focused on discrete plan changes, and therefore I think in the way that you need to approach it, you don't need to follow that case law to the letter. Indeed, you shouldn't follow that case law to the letter, because we are dealing with nominally a wide scale plan review. So when matters are or areas of land are clearly within scope, and the issues that are raised by submissions are resource management issues, at a threshold level, you have jurisdiction to deal with. In my submission, a relatively simple way of dealing with the issues is, first of all, at a geographic level, do submitters raise issues about areas of land that are plainly zoned and identified within stage one? If so, then you move on to the next level of analysis of scope, which is, are the issues raised in the relief sought in relation to that particular land? Is that a topic that is dealt with in this stage? Or is it a matter that is dealt with at a separate stage or excluded? And if it is those latter two categories, then that raises the scope issue. And we have set out in Schedule 3 for the submissions five categories of issues and submissions that raise scope issues. And we recognise, of course, that that is not going to be exhaustive on the issue of scope, and there will no doubt be numerous instances where you need to deal with this. one point I should emphasise is that given the importance of this issue, and particularly for submitters and their fair and effective participation in this process, it would be helpful in my submission that the panel is able to give consideration to the question of scope. And as part of, or at the end of this hearing, issue a minute or direction, quite necessarily binding, but at least giving some guidance to participants in the process as to how it intends to deal with the issue of scope. Finally, at section 9 of the submissions, a response is provided to the panel's memorandum of 16 February 2016, raising a number of issues about errors and inconsistencies. There are solutions. They are mostly in council's hands at this stage, but we're grateful to the panel for identifying these issues. There's obviously the opportunity to exercise the powers under Clause 16 to rectify inconsistencies and minor errors, and that analysis will be undertaken and appropriate action will be taken. And there's also the potential to use the powers under Clause 18 for the schedule to withdraw relevant parts of the proposed plan. So there's a bit of a skate over those written submissions, and obviously happy to answer any questions that arise about those or other related matters.
Thank you. Commissioner Robinson, do you have any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Winchester, I want to start with Section 32. Because this is an issue that is common to all of the chapters that we will be considering and all of the chapters that subsequent hearing panels will be considering. And I want to make it clear at the outset that I haven't read the Section 32 analyses for the chapters, later chapters that I'm not going to be involved in. And the thing that's troubling me is turning to the requirements of Section 32.2. You should probably have it in front of you, although you might have it memorised. which is, of course, the requirement of any assessment for assessing the efficiency and effectiveness of policies must identify and assess the benefits and costs, including the opportunities for economic growth anticipated and employment. And then B, if practicable, quantify the benefits and costs referred to in paragraph A. And without wishing to put a closed question to you, I was utterly unable to find any quantification of any policy in the Section 32 analyses for chapters 3 through 6, and nor is there a discussion as to whether it was practicable to have done so and why one wasn't undertaken. And I'd invite you to respond on behalf of the Council at a general level as to whether that creates a problem for us.
In my submission, it doesn't create a problem, and the reason for that is the chapters are strategic chapters. They set out a high-level strategic approach. They are not... Ultimately, they will translate into more specific chapters that have much more direct regulatory effect. And it's at that point when you're dealing with the more mechanical chapters that are topic specific, that sort of analysis of specific plan provisions and how they work and how they're administered will have far greater relevance in terms of that Section 32.2 assessment. As to whether it would have been practicable to undertake a quantification of the costs and benefits and economic growth that's anticipated to be provided or reduced, or employment that's anticipated to be provided or reduced. Evidence could potentially have been produced on that issue from an economist, a challenge for any economist to read the chapters that we are dealing with and come up with a sensible, reliable quantification of those economic impacts based on an analysis of those chapters by themselves. It would have to have been either so heavily qualified or, with respect, involve substantial guesswork that its value would be significantly limited. In my submission, that such evidence is not required to assist you, and it would not assist you in determining whether the strategic approach outlined in these chapters is appropriate or not.
Two follow-up points. The first is that while I can understand your emphasis on the strategic nature of the chapters before us, the Section 32 analysis for Chapter 6 is in fact combined with the Section 32 analysis for the rural chapter, which is going to be heard later in the hearings, which does delve into practical issues of what rules apply in the rural environment. And to my reading, and I stand to be corrected, there's no quantification of the costs and benefits of those policies and those rules either. And obviously, because that hearing is in the future, that is something that could yet be addressed, and invite you to consider whether it might be a good idea to do just that.
So thank you for that indication. I can relay that work has commenced on that very issue. That's something that has been identified by sales and council officers, and an analysis has been commissioned.
Thank you for that. And lastly, in relation on this point, in relation to Section 32.2A2, there's a specific requirement that the assessment of benefits and costs include the opportunities for employment that are anticipated to be provided. And taking your point that these are strategic chapters and this could be a qualitative assessment, I suppose I should put it in an open way. Can you point to me where that has in fact been done?
No, I can't see it.
The witnesses in the back perhaps should be mulling that one over. Now, going on, there is a, and I apologise in advance that there's a lack of logic to my questions, and this may be something for you to take away and respond to, I suspect it probably is. There is a specific legal issue that has been raised in the legal submissions for Queenstown Airport regarding the scope for the recommendations to policy 6.3.1.8, the argument that is that the submissions do not support the recommended change. And I just ask you to take a note of that and respond at leisure with comments as to whether you think that submission is valid or not, and if the latter, your reasons for that position.
Yes, I'll respond to that in more detail and I can answer now.
Yes, I thought that might be a bit optimistic. That's also in relation to Queenstown Airport. Queenstown Airport's position is heavily based on the argument that a lot of effort has gone into finalising PC35 and that the provisions of that plan change should be translated. I'm not sure they would go so far as saying verbatim, but almost into this plan change. That's a mixed question of law and planning. Obviously, we'll discuss Mr. Pade's the planning issue, but as a matter of law, what's your position on that? Do you think that we are required to translate PC 35 into the plan? And just to fill that out a little, and to the extent that we have any legal obligation, what do you think the meets and bounds of that obligation are?
There is no obligation on the council as initiator of the proposed plan, nor for the panel in your role to recommend relief to translate that plan change verbatim into the proposed plan. There is always the opportunity and availability of alternative approaches. There may be changes of facts and circumstances between now and when the detail of those plan provisions became finalised, and I understand they're not actually properly final. Final approval of PC35 is still related to the outcome of parallel environmental proceedings. Notwithstanding that, I think the legal issue comes about in terms of Section 32. Bearing in mind the degree of investment, degree of analysis that has gone into where PC35 got to, the fact that it is relatively recent, also the PC35 is forward-looking, but you know, it's not a snapshot in time necessarily, it's looking about the relationship between the airport and surrounding development into the future. The costs and benefits of taking an alternative approach, a materially different approach, we need to be carefully considered. So there's a process and a substance dimension to that.
Now, going on in the Queenstown Airport case, Ms. Walt for Queenstown Airport, among other submissions, submits that the Supreme Court's decision on the King Salmon litigation is authority for the proposition that policies, objectives and policies focusing on protection of particular resources and avoidance of particular effects require that the rules giving implementing those objectives and policies have non-complying or prohibited status. And I wanted to ask whether you had a view on that proposition.
My view on that proposition is that the authority for, or the authority for that proposition isn't entirely clear from the King Salmon case. King Salmon doesn't say that, but it's a logical inference that can be reached. And it's possibly more of an issue that I'd suggest you put to some of the planning witnesses as to whether the policy response to that judicial authority is the most appropriate response to the form of complying to any status. But as I say, as a man before, I don't read King Salmon as saying that. But it does raise a question as a matter of law as to how you would give effect to that instrument with a lesser or less restrictive activity status. But it requires a case-by-case assessment, in my submission.
Thank you for that. Turning more generally to the cases that will be put to us, there's a lot of emphasis in the planning evidence and to the extent that we have legal submissions from submitters in the legal submissions also urging us to use what has been paraphrased as RMA language rather than coming up with new descriptions. Do you have any comment on the legal obligations that we have in this regard?
So you're referring to the reference to goals?
Well, no, that's a separate question.
I see.
So to give you an example, the proposed plan as recommended by staff uses the term degrade in a number of places. Number of the planning witnesses say, well, we should talk about avoiding, remedying, or mitigating adverse effects, as an example. Do you have any comment, a general comment, on the legal obligations we have? There's clearly a planning issue underlying it.
I don't see any. In my submission, there are no statutory directions, nor judicial authority that I'm aware of that say that the language that's used must mirror or mimic that of the RMA. Obviously, it might help in certain instances where there's judicial authority on what a specific piece of the Act means. How it should be applied or interpreted, that might assist in terms of the certainty and administration of plan provisions. But by the same token, in my experience, there is a movement to a more direct use of language about, particularly about what outcomes should be. And to the extent that language is clear, is able to be understood by members of the public and professionals and can be applied, there is no legal constraint I'm aware of in using language which differs from the statutory language of the RMA.
Now, I wanted now to please pulling up the electronic version so I can have it in front of me to discuss the definition of urban development, since that's really at the heart of the urban growth boundaries. And in a very open way, I'd like you to explain, please, what it means.
I think what it's meant to mean is that anything within any development within and identified urban growth boundary as urban development. It's not necessarily what it says at the moment.
And that was the problem I had, having read it at least a dozen times and having read the Environment Court's interpretation of it in relation to the Arrowtown urban limits. I think the most charitable way that the Environment Courts describe is the approach could be regarded as that the Environment Court interpreted the definition by going back to the policies and trying to make sense of what the policies said. And the Environment Court also said it would be helpful that wasn't necessary, and that the definition, if it was going to add value, actually said what it meant. Do you think that there is room for amendment? And how would you suggest that definition be amended, assuming there's jurisdiction to do so?
Yes, well, scope is an obvious issue there. I may have looked into that scope issue in particular. Just by way of context, a certain irony in the Environment Court's criticism of the definition, given that it came about from the Environment Consent Order from the same division of the court. So, having approved it, it was then criticised. But, notwithstanding that, it, on its face, is not straightforward. To me, there's an obvious deletion that can be made which would assist, and it's removing the words in terms of its characteristics such as density and its effects apart from bulk and location. And then you start getting a bit closer to, I think, what it should say. But then the words could be established as of right in any such zone are problematic because, you know, not all activities are permitted. And there may still be activities which are fairly anticipated within zones, but still require resource consent for control of restricted discretionary activity. So those sort of qualifications on the definition are, in my submission, particularly unhelpful because they require quite a degree of subjectivity and judgment as to how the definitions apply. In my submission, it would be helpful to start from scratch and think about, in the context of this plan and this strategic approach, what it's intending to achieve, and saying that. I don't think it will necessarily be that much different to the core of this definition, but if we strip away some of the extraneous stuff, it will help a great deal. And certainly it has been exercising our minds since the panel issued its question last week.
Isn't the real problem with the definition, though, that it actually specifically excludes development in the areas where the definition is needed outside the urban growth boundaries? Because effectively it says that whatever development you do outside the urban growth boundaries is not urban development. And that is pointless in its application, isn't it?
Could potentially be self-defeating, particularly given the structure of what this approach and this proposed plan. Mm. So really urban development is development of a nature, density, character, which is anticipated within urban growth boundaries.
Well, even that ends up being circular, I think. I think there are some examples in other regional policy statements and plans that it would be helpful if council staff could examine the extent to which there's jurisdiction to amend that definition and present to us. I mean, the Auckland Regional Council have grappled with this for something like 20 years in the regional policy statement, reasonably successfully.
And in terms of jurisdiction, I think that you might find that you get at least partway down the way, down the track, with the Millbrook submission.
Yes.
And Millbrook has raised the question as to, given the definition, is there an urban development which should in fact be avoided, or further extensions of it should be avoided? Well, one solution might be to redraw the Arrowtown urban boundary. That's an issue for another day. But I think in terms of the thinking underpinning the definition, where do those special zones like Millbrook sit?
Yes, and that's a discussion that is ongoing, certainly amongst the council's team. It is obviously a live issue. There are different ways of addressing it, some of them relatively subtle, some of them far more blunt. But we are discussing those, and I think officers will come back with recommendations, obviously.
One of the things that the officers' team might consider looking at, as Mr. Chair has adverted to, there is a definition in the operative Auckland RPS that has been litigated uphill and down dale, so there's lots of case law as to what it means. Another avenue you might consider drawing thoughts from is section 76 4C, which defines what an urban environment is for the purposes of the tree rules.
That issue's been discussed this morning, sir. I don't know, views about that. Won't necessarily delay. But thank you for that information.
While we're on definitions, the other definition that I wanted your guidance and assistance with is the definition of nature conservation values. Particularly as it's used in the context of the strategic chapter 3242, which seems to be the relevant point of maybe may well be later in the plan as well. And to my eye, the definition doesn't seem to quite work or to capture what you try to achieve. And I wanted your comment on that. Is that a problem with the definition or a problem with the policy? Or the objective, actually, 3242, protect areas with significant nature conservation values. I insert the definition into that objective and it doesn't seem to make sense.
In terms of the possible double counting?
Yes.
I take it, sir, yes, I think that probably needs some closer attention. I can't come up with an answer right at the moment, but I see what the issue is.
Yes, if you could put that one in your on your list of actions to think about.
Yeah.
The next one I want to talk about is the incorporation by reference of iwi management plans. And in Mr. Pickard's report, there's a reference to the fact that this has been done under clause 30 of the first schedule. And I wanted to ask you if you could please identify which component of clause 30 would an iwi management plan fall within.
Sit comfortably with any of those categories, sir. I accept that. I think it's probably most comfortably within clause 31C. I don't necessarily think it's sort of deals with technical matters per se. Description of the document that's far more substantial than that. I suppose the only submission, other alternative submission I'd make about that is that 31, isn't necessarily exhaustive. It's got the following written material may be incorporated, obviously, at his discretion, and potentially provides the opportunity for other classes of material to also be incorporated. That's just an initial reaction. I haven't looked at any particular authority on that point, so.
Is there anything in around about section 75 in that regard? Incorporation?
Well, section 75 doesn't deal with incorporation.
It's just in terms of that recognition or that of the management plans, is there anything in that area at all?
Well, it's in section 74.
74.
And that I mean, it's a man that must be here to show the bigger crowd to. So it's, I suppose the question is, how does this council want to recognise that particular document and give it importance and determine appropriate to do so by incorporating it by reference, which obviously ultimately gives it greater weight and impact in administration and decision making.
Isn't the practical use of it when dealing with resource consents under section 104? And in my experience of other plans, particularly regional plans, they quite often specify that iwi management plans are a matter for consideration. Wouldn't that be a more practical way to give that important recognition in the plan? Because even if it's incorporated as part of the plan, there's nothing in the plan that directs a decision maker on a resource consent to actually consider it.
Well, I think that part did serve that's another solution, possibly one which might be more effective and may not give rise to the issues around whether the clause 30 power is applicable in this instance. I'm not sure that's necessarily a significant legal issue, but in terms of achieving the intended outcome, there may be other ways of doing this.
I think that where the rubber hits the road is in relation to policy 5.4.1.3, which currently reads, and I think Mr. Picard's recommendation is that it's not changed, when making resource management decisions, ensure that functions and powers are exercised in a manner that takes into account iwi management plans. I think the 5 that's in the staff report is in fact footnote 5 rather than the take into account 5 iwi management plans. And that the discussion in Mr. Carr's report refers back to the fact that they are incorporated by reference to answer a submission by Real Journeys, that it ought to be specific as to which ones, and in particular the ones that are currently known. Now, that there are two related questions, partly planning, partly law, as to whether, given the ambit of section 74.2A and the generic reference in section 104 to other relevant documents, whether that should be sustained. So do you have any comments that would assist us on that point? Is there any legal principles on that submission, or is it purely a planning issue, whether it should be the current EV management plans, or which are the ones incorporated by reference, or such EV management plans as they happen to be in relevant locations from relevant arms of the EV from time to time?
Well, there's obviously an issue there in that if a document is incorporated by reference, it is a specific version of a document, doesn't allow it to be updated, modified over time to respond to different circumstances. So you sort of stuck with it, and if you want to incorporate a later version, you need to go for a plan change to do so. So that, I think, is reasonably orthodox law. That then raises the question as to whether you want to specify in another part of the plan or through a different type of approach of identifying the importance of those documents, whether you want to name those documents specifically, say they're matters that need to be had regard to, or you want to do it more generally. Say, for example, you use the wording that you just referred to, that such EV management plans that are in existence at this time. And that obviously leads to an administration issue for the council and possibly a degree of uncertainty for applicants, although these documents are now publicly available. So, in my submission, there's no major legal issue that arises if it becomes a planning one.
And I suppose, while I'm talking to you on the subject, do you think it might be a good idea, talks about Ngāi Tahu EV management plans, since I doubt if anyone particularly interested in what Ngāti Tuwharetoa or Ngāti Porou might have said, and it's utterly non-specific at the moment.
No, although the chapter does refer to two specific plans at the moment, so it's...
If it were generalised, I mean.
Oh, absolutely, but I mean, there's obviously a relevance issue there. But on Belts and Braces approach, I see where you're coming from.
Now, changing the subject, but still in a legal issue arising out of Mr. Pickard's report, he states, I might say confidently, that the phrase take into account imposes a higher onus than have regard. And I wanted to ask you whether you agreed with that, and if so, whether you could explain to me what the difference is.
In my submission, there is, and I don't have the case at my fingertips, but there are a number of cases that have compared the statutory language and I think ultimately with regard to those two phrases there is not necessarily much of a difference. In both instances you need to demonstrate that you've turned your mind to the relevant matters, that you have in your decision making somehow weighed them,